There's a guy who walked into a bus station and meets another guy who, and they know each other. The one is a Christian, the other one not. The one who is not a Christian says to the one who is a Christian, "Jesus is dead." The Christian looked very surprised and said, "Can't be, just talk to him." Well, that's where the divide is. There are some who believe that Jesus is risen from the dead and he's alive, and some don't. But that's Easter. We as Christians celebrate Easter as the event that marks the day when Jesus rose from the dead. It is on this day that 8 million Christians in Egypt meet together today with strict surveillance and security guards and defy all odds to come together and celebrate Easter in spite of what happened last week. There's a small group of Christians today that celebrate Easter a little bit outside of Mosul. They come together in what is left of the church and celebrate Easter because just 2-3 years ago, they were forced to pay taxes and convert to Islam or die by sword. But here they are together and celebrate Easter, that Jesus is alive. Many of those festivities started on Good Friday, when we came together and to commemorate that Jesus died on the cross. We here had our tenebrae service. We left this sanctuary very quiet, very subdued, understanding that what happened was probably one of the greatest tragedies, that Jesus was murdered and killed innocently there on the cross. And now we are here to celebrate Easter, that he is alive, rose from the dead, the most important festivity in Christian history. Canada celebrated a very important event just last week. It was the 100th anniversary of Vimy Ridge. It was at that event that for the first time all four Canadian divisions were assembled to operate in combat as a corps. They fought alongside the British and create an alliance to fight against the Germans. 3,598 Canadians were killed. 7,004 were wounded. Many believe that this victory created a sense of Canadian identity for our country, the beginning of a nation. And without a doubt, this important in the history of our country as we remember those who have given their lives so that others can live. And today is Easter. We as Christians celebrate Easter. And in many ways, there are similarities with those events. Vimy Ridge doesn't mean anything to anyone who has not any kind of relationship to that event, either by family history or by not knowing about this. It makes only sense to you when you read about it, when you have a relationship with that event, and when you get informed what happened there. Then Vimy Ridge might be important to you. And that's the same with Easter. Easter may not mean anything to you if we have no relationship with this event. If you have never celebrated at home other than it was a good holiday and you go for an Easter egg hunt, but above and beyond that had no meaning. Unless you grew up in a family that had Easter traditions and had some Christian roots and celebrated that event as a Christian event. Or you start to inform yourself and read up on what is this all about, this thing where Christians all over the world come together to celebrate Easter. And in both events, we celebrate the fact that someone gave his life so that others can live. But that's where the similarities end. Easter is not just a memory. Easter is not just something that happened in the past. Easter is actually a beginning. Easter is the beginning of something new, a new reality. Easter is not a memorial. Easter is a signpost. A signpost to a future, to a new reality of what is going to happen. And that story of Easter is still lived out today, on this very day that we are here together. And this is evidenced by the story that we heard this morning that Pastor Dan was reading to us. It's taken out of a larger context in the early years of Christianity, when Christianity was about to be formed and the early disciples had to come to grips with what happened at Easter. That event that they could not explain, that they didn't even expect, in spite of the fact that they were informed about this several times that this will happen, but it still didn't make sense to them. And then they had to come to grips with this thing that the Jesus that they just saw to be nailed at the cross and then be put into the grave, that this Jesus is actually alive. That he is alive and that the women met him there at the graveside. And then they came back totally excited that this Jesus that they put into their grave is alive. So they had to come to grips with this story that was so unbelievable that it's almost, you know, you wouldn't even dare to tell the story unless it's true. Because otherwise, excuse me, but you would be the greatest idiots, you know, to say a story that's not true, you know, and go to all the world and tell the story. Something must have happened. So what happened here? What's the framework of the story of the text that we heard this morning? It starts with a Roman officer who was stationed in Caesarea in a town that was Romish, was built by Rome to commemorate Rome and the Caesars, right there in the Jewish land. This guy, this Cornelius, that was his name, was attracted to the Roman religion. He prayed to God regularly and he belonged to those people that were called God-fearing. So they were not Jews per se, but they were attracted to this kind of religion that the Jewish portrayed. And it seems like he influenced his household to do the same. Because it says in the story that his whole household, those who belonged to him, those sons and daughters and whoever lived with him in his household, also practiced what he practiced. He was also known for somebody who supported charities, who helped out those who were poor and who contributed to them. In many ways, he did not fit the typical profile of a Roman soldier, of somebody who occupied this country that he lived in. And then it happened. One morning while he was doing his prayers, he was visited by what he calls an angel. And this angel related a certain message to him and said, "Hey, Cornelius, God has heard you. He has seen what you have done. Go and send to this Simon called Peter and bring him here and he will tell you what to do." Cornelius, being a soldier, knew what to do with orders. If somebody gives an order, you do what you need to do. And that's exactly what he did. The next day, while his agents went out there to look for Peter, just 65 kilometers north, Peter is having a nap time on the roof of the house. He stays at a bed and breakfast, if you will. He is a guest there. And he just waits for food to be prepared. And as he does so, he falls into sleep and sees in a dream, in a vision, a big sheet let down from heaven filled with animals that were unclean to his Jewish background. We know that the Jews had very strict dietary restrictions when it comes to what they are supposed to eat and what is not, even to this day. And then a voice from heaven said, "Eat, kill and eat." And he said, "Oh, no, 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 this is not what I'm supposed to do." These eating restrictions and eating rules and regulations separated Jews from all people around them. They never would sit at the table with anyone who would not follow the same rules. So they always lived a very separated and distinct identity and a distinct life. And here he was called to bridge that, and he protested, as we know from this story. And then those messengers from Cornelius arrive. Simon hosts them for the night and asks them what this is all about. And now Peter understands he needs to venture out into very unfamiliar territory. He needs to move out of his comfort zone. He needs to travel to this Roman city of Caesarea where nobody actually wanted to go if they didn't have to. He had to visit a Roman soldier in his house and he's had to speak to an audience that had no clue what Christianity or what this was all about. It was almost humorous what happened when he entered the house. The first thing that comes out of his mouth is, "I shouldn't be here." He somehow knew this is all too strange. This is not fitting. I shouldn't be here. I cannot actually be in this household and have coffee or lunch with you. It's not possible, but things happened. And that's why I'm here. So tell me, why am I here? And then Cornelius starts to tell the story that happened to him. And then we have this aha moment happening to Peter. A light went on in his head, and all of a sudden, all the story, first of all, what he experienced himself, and all the other things that he has heard before from the mouth of this Jesus made sense. The first thing that comes to his mind is this one single truth it says in this text, God does not show favoritism. And all along he thought that he is on the Jews' side. He is a Jewish God, a tribal God, if you will, who just belongs to the Jews and the rest, well, they're just outsiders. They don't belong to where we are. And if, then they have to come to our level. And all of a sudden, his light goes on and he understands this kind of a God is a different God, much bigger than I ever thought. God does not show favoritism. And all that Peter can come up with for this very moment is start to tell the story of what he has heard and seen over the last 3.5 years in Galilee, in Judea and Jerusalem. It almost sounds clumsy. He hasn't prepared a sermon for this occasion. He hasn't prepared to say what he needed to say for this moment. He didn't even know what to do. And all he has to do at that moment is tell a story. He says, hey, listen, this is what happened. This is what's happened over the last 3 years. We walked with this Jesus, and he did good things, and he raised, he healed people, and he raised other people from the dead. And then there is this big event that you probably have heard about in Jerusalem, where he was nailed to the cross, and then he rose again. And we are here to be the witnesses of this story. It was all too unheard of, but nevertheless true. We were witnesses of that. We saw that this happened. We just didn't read a book. We just didn't hear it in the news. We were there. We saw it all with our own eyes. Here's what he shared, according to our text. It says, as for the word that he has sent to Israel, preaching the good news of peace to Jesus Christ, he is Lord of all. You yourselves know what happened throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee and after the baptism of John proclaimed, how God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and with power. He went about doing good, healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. And we are witnesses of that all he did, both in the country of the Jews and in Jerusalem. They put him unto death by hanging on the tree. But God raised him on the third day and made him to appear, not to all people, but to us who have been chosen by God as witnesses, who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. This is the story of Easter in a nutshell. He brings it all down. This is what happened. And it's almost like, and you just do with it what you need to do. This is the story. Jesus is the one. But there was more happening in Peter's mind. And I think that is the whole idea of this story. Peter realizes that Jesus' ministry, his death and resurrection, is God's global rescue plan. Not just for the Jews, but this is truly God's global rescue plan. Because here in this event, the almost tribal faith of these few people there in Palestine, in Judea, jumps a big hurdle into other groups of people, and here the Romans. What began with Abraham as a story and history of the Jewish people is far more than that. It was and is God's plan to restore this world and bring it back to rights. It is a plan to restore mankind to its calling, what they're supposed to have been and what they have lost, and that is to represent God in this world. The cross, the grave, is not a memorial, as we have mentioned. It's a signpost, and that's what he understood. A signpost for the future. Easter is the beginning of a new reality. The new world of God is here among us. Jesus mentioned it several times. The kingdom of God is here. God's reign is here, accessible to everyone who wants to. This new world is right here with us. It has finally arrived. God has put this all back together and is about putting it all back together. And Jesus plays the central role in this whole plan. This is new life. It is a new world, new hope, right here among us. And it works its way to the present world like yeast when you put it into dough. It's, if you will, a conspiracy of good life, of the good life. And this good life is accessible to everyone. And that's exactly what he understood. This good life that the Jews were privileged to live for a while is now accessible to everyone who wants to be part of that. God is about to redo and recreate his earth. This seemingly obscure event in that house of Cornelius changed history forever. It's not just what Jesus did on the cross and that he rose again. Here it is, the disciples who understood for the very first time the meaning of what it all was about. It is bigger than we thought. It is way bigger than we ever thought it is. It has ramifications for the rest of the world. In this case, for the Roman oppressors. The one who were our enemies, that's what Peter thought. The ones who taxed us to the hills. The one who put us down. The one who were mean to us. They are the ones to whom God is opening the opportunity to be part of what he is doing. And what happened there in Caesarea swapped over into the entire world. 300 years later, half of the Roman Empire was under the influence of Christianity. And even non-Christian writers still try to figure that out. What is it? Why did that happen? A heavy price was to be paid. Jesus paid that price. And many of his followers paid a price for that as well, especially in the first 300 years of Christianity. They had to die a brutal death, either on the cross or thrown before lions. But they were willing to give up their lives because they understood what they believed. And here it is what it boils down to. Jesus is the central figure of God's plan. The story of Abraham and the patriarchs, as well as the story of the Jewish people, finds in Jesus its fulfillment. And everyone must be and will be judged by Jesus. There is no other plan. There is no other name. Jesus becomes the central figure of history. It says in our text this way, that's how Peter says it. He is the one appointed by God to be judge of the living and the dead. If Jesus really rose from the dead, you have two choices. You either believe that, or you think that Jesus is simply crazy and the whole story is fiction. Eventually, you have to decide what you make with Jesus. Either you put him aside and say, well, that's done and over with, old ancient story, nothing to it. Or you dig into the story and say, well, if this is all true, if Jesus and what Christians always have proclaimed, if this is truly the truth, that Jesus is risen from the dead, alive, that he truly had conquered death, then a new reality has begun. And I have to deal with that. I have to deal with this Jesus. I can't get by him. I can't get past him. I can't put him back into the grave. He is alive. And the question then is, how can I access this life? What does it take? What does it take to be part of that if I want to, if I feel like this is what I need to do? And the answer is very simple. That's the answer that was given over thousands of years, and that is simple, believe in Jesus. Believe in Jesus. And the question is, what does that mean? What does it really mean if I would tell you just believe in Jesus? So easy rolls from our lips. Two things. First, to believe in Jesus means that I put that Jesus is God's solution for the world as it is today. That I believe that. That Jesus is God's solution for the world today to save this world as it is. And it sounds so very ridiculous to think about that. But there's other religions who preach other things, and we know that. But here's what Christianity has to present and says this is it, that Jesus is God's solution. That he has worked all through history up to this point. That he put all the evil, all that has happened on Jesus, and that he died a substitutionary death. A death where he took upon himself all that was wrong in this world. And that in Jesus, God is putting this world back to rights. Christ has condemned evil once and for all on the cross. He has shown very clearly on the cross what he thinks about all that evil that is happening in this world. It's right there on the cross. He hates it. But then he has come back to life. He has overcome evil by raising Jesus from the dead. And there is a new world, is a new life, is new hope blooming since Jesus rose from the dead. And this new life is since then available. That's what I need to, first of all, come to grips with. Believe. This is what God has done, and I need to understand that and try to wrap my head around this. But the second part of believing in Jesus has a very personal aspect. Because I have to then ask, so, and what does it mean for me? If this is one way, that the way, that Jesus' way is the solution, then what does it mean for me if I join his movement? And that means for me that I now believe that Jesus is true. That the principles that he taught are right. And that they're worth living out. That I submit myself to this Jesus and to his teachings and just say, Jesus, this is what I want to represent today. I want to be one of your followers, one of those Jesus people who live like you did, who submit to your kind of lifestyle. And that's what Christianity is all about. That's what Christians then call disciples. They follow this Jesus. They learn from this Jesus how to live this kind of life that Jesus lived, and in order to become like him, to be like him. And this is certainly a process, but this is what it means to believe in Jesus. That I put him on that place where it says where he belongs, and said he is the one that I follow. His principles are right, and I trust that he will do what he promised to do. And it comes all back to this one thing. Either I trust really that he is, or don't. Either I trust that this is really the solution. This is really the way how we conquer evil. This is the way how we conquer all the stuff that's wrong, or it's not. But this is what it boils down to in my very personal life, to say this is what I am. I believe in Jesus or I'm not. And if I believe in Jesus, if I confess that, then I represent him and his program and his plan, and I present this into this world. I present this above my neighbors and my colleagues and my friends, and I'm unashamedly part of his movement. And this will certainly not be always easy. We are very well aware of that, because it's so different when we stop lying, stop cheating, be honest, when we apply the principles that Jesus lived out in my own life. And that also would then lead eventually to the point that I die. That's what the Bible often says, that I die to myself and I live a new identity, a new life, a life that is lived now for Jesus Christ. And the Bible and New Testament writers write very clearly about this, that we die with Christ and that we rise with Christ to a new life, to a new identity, that we are now those people who follow Jesus Christ. And today, all over the world, this is celebrated. Christ lives. Jesus lives. He is alive among his people. He is alive among Christians. He is alive among his people and his kingdom that he is building in this earth. And he is alive among us and among you and me. This is what we are experiencing today in a very symbolic way.